Welcome to Shed Talks, episode 19. Our highly esteemed guest is the hugely talented writer, director, playwright, and drummer, Paul Unwin. Perhaps best known as the co-creator of the enormously successful medical television series Casualty, now in its unbelievable 38th year. Born in 1957, due to his parents working in the diplomatic service, he had to go to various schools all over the world, Budapest, Tokyo, New York, and more unhappily, in England. Diagnosed as dyslexic, he eventually ended up at the slightly liberal hippie boarding school of Beedales in England, which made him happy because it taught him about drumming and writing plays. Hooray! However, shortly after leaving school, aged just 19, alongside the band he was a member of, Paul was involved in a terrible tragedy that most of us would find impossible to come back from. And it's that trauma that we're going to talk about in this episode. Moving on a little bit, after a considerable period of time after this, Paul went off and had a very successful career in the theatre, film, telly world, kicking off with being the youngest artistic director of the Bristol Old Vic, including working and becoming friends with the legendary playwright Arthur Miller. Finally, he is the father of two children and the husband to Kate, who he describes as his very best friend and wife. Please give a very big welcome to Paul Unwin.
Jeremy, thank you. What a lovely introduction. Made me blush.
So, Paul, it's really good to have you here. It's going to be a very interesting chat. I just wondered if I could just ask you, you know, just two or three questions out of the blue, really. And I wondered if you could tell me about your parents, what they're like and what they meant to you, what they are to you.
Well, staggeringly, my mum and dad are still alive. They became great-grandparents this weekend, which we're all thrilled about. They are 91, 93, I think. My mother was born in Germany to a Jewish father.
Right.
Escaped Germany through Amsterdam in 1938 and came to Britain with her father and mother. Her father died quite quickly afterwards, and then her mother died in 1952. So she grew up as she had quite a traumatic journey to yes. becoming an adult. She got went to Oxford University. She was educated by Catholic nuns at Carl Shorten, and she's now and regards herself in life as a Catholic. From that, got to Oxford, met my dad, who came from Middlesbrough, from a lovely a small family, much more straightforward, I suspect, than my mother's parents.
Right.
So my father had a kind of rather brilliant. It's a kind of escape story, I guess. I mean, he you know, moving from being a kid at a Middlesbrough hardware store in the war to becoming a diplomat, joining the diplomatic services in the early 50s when it was at its pomp, and kind of rising up through that. So their journey together was their two stories are very much part of mine and my older sister, my younger brother, and my younger sister.
Yes.
The four of us are very close. My mother's traumatic early life, while it wasn't as traumatic as being in a concentration camp or even on the kinder transport, she did come here to save her life.
Yes.
And I think that psychologically hangs over a family for quite a few generations. I think it's quite in terms of mental health and in terms yes. of emotional and psychological attitudes, I think those things are quite important. And I do remember very clearly my mum and my dad sitting us down and telling us why we had no relatives on my mum's side. And, you know, there's a letter in the family folder, which is, you know, about those that died in Treblinka and those that died in Auschwitz. So it's a strange, distant, but very close thing.
It's stark as well. Yeah.
In sort of how that affects personality and family, my brother and sister and I will talk about that we think that quite early on we were taught, guys, you've got to look out for yourselves.
Yeah. But I mean, to me, maybe what that created in is some sort of survival instinct in the DNA of the Unwins, you know, because that's quite something. I mean, we won't turn on about it, but I look at that and I think, well, it's lucky she was in Hamburg. It's Hamburg's port. But I mean, great.
Luck plays a huge part in the story we're going to be talking about today.
So basically, going to Beedel's, what must have been, once you got there for a month, you must have thought you'd gone to sort of heaven, really.
Well, I was both confused because I was dyslexic, but Beedel's was this liberal, artistic and co-educational and that environment. And suddenly I found women, to be honest, dope. To be honest, suddenly going, I can read, because dyslexia is this strange thing where as puberty hits, it seemed to me to clear up,
right.
More to discuss. And so I had these fabulous 4 years, which were just some great teachers, actually, learning a lot. I was in a shared a room with Dan Day-Lewis, the actor. We were sort of mad competitive friends. You laugh, but I laugh still. And played in a rock and roll band and just had 4 or 5 years of, I think in hindsight, incredibly spoiled.
Incredibly
privileged.
Yes. I understand mean, that, but in a way it's allowing you to be yourself, but it's quite your spoiled self. So let's go there. Let's go to, the band was on the edge, right?
The band was on edge.
I'm on edge. Very mental health title, obviously, anticipated Shed Talks.
We spent 2 years locking ourselves in a room at the rather wonderful music department at Beedale's, and just played the fuck out of it. I have tapes, which I sort of, because of what happened, I don't really listen to. Have done a long time ago, and they're not bad. I'm not sure we would ever have been international, but gigs.
Anyway, let us get to the meat and potatoes.
So what happened, and is, as you say, the meat of
yeah.
or part of the meat of the story, was in July 1976, the band, we went to stay at one of the band members' parents' house.
Yes.
Which was in the Black Hills outside of Accrington.
Yes.
We sort of holed up in a barn and thought we'd get our shit together properly. But if you remember, the summer of 1976 was phenomenally hot.
It was
a great, great heat wave. And we practiced and we went out at night and we did other things. On this day, we all went to a pub and I think we played, but I don't remember this.
Right.
And coming back that night, five of us got into a mini.
And it was, whose mini was it?
It was one of the people who died who was driving. And right. I sat in the back. And
so you had six people in the car?
Six people in the car. And we, which was overloaded. And I think there'd been drink. But that wasn't what happened. What appears to have happened is we were going onto a dual carriageway. And the roads had got slippery. It had rained because of the heat, the tarmac and oil, and the roads were slippery, and we skidded onto a dual carriageway, which in those days didn't have a central barrier, and collided head-on, as far as I know, with a car coming the other way, which had a father and his daughter. And everyone was killed but me. I don't really remember the run-up to the accident, though I had strong memories of the day. I think I may have memories, which I've done therapy about, which are pretty dark.
Yes. But
broadly, I woke up in the Royal Victoria Hospital male surgical ward 1 with my head shaved, a catheter draining my bladder in a weird 1976 form of traction because I'd broken my pelvis, my back, my femur.
Oh, you had broken your back?
My sternum, below my pelvis. So I'd cracked that. And I was really, really, really poorly and awful. I didn't know this at the time. I didn't know anything. I didn't know that everyone had been killed.
They didn't tell you?
No. What had happened is my poor sister, Julia, who happened to be living in Liverpool at the time, was told that my parents were bored, and my sister was told that she had to come and sort of identify her brother because they thought I was dead. But what had happened is I'd swapped jackets. I was cold from playing the drums and had swapped jackets with someone who had died. And so I was misidentified. Right. So when she came to the hospital, I've never had this conversation, but I hope she saw me first. So there was big trauma. There are a long period of very dark and complex memories because it took some time to be told what had happened. It took longer to process what had happened, much longer, because you go, well, I'm alive.
And did you believe it? Did you believe it?
That it had happened?
Yes.
Well, I think I did. I think I did.
Jeff. I mean, presumably, when the crash happened, it sounds like it was a very high impact thing, I guess it must have been, that they must have been going very fast.
Well, I know it was a head-on collision, and I know that I survived, we think, because I was in the back and I had someone on my lap.
Yes.
So, but... Yeah. But it's a weird thing, and it fascinates me. I'm not ashamed of using that word.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, but it lives with me every day. It's a long time ago, and I think I kind of understand it, but it's a long time ago, and it makes absolutely no sense at all.
I understand that. And I totally understand the way in which you're talking about it, because you're talking about something that happened nearly 40 years ago. But it's hugely traumatic, and that's just an understatement in a way. But what is weird is reading about it and seeing what happened to you in the hospital, which you may not want to talk about, and then, you know, sort of being left on your own. And I mean that in all sorts of ways, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite something that you came through it. And, I mean, I want to talk about that, of how it really, you know, later. But, I mean, most extraordinary. And, of course, we're talking about a time when, you know, Accrington General Hospital was Accrington General Hospital. It wasn't like sort of, would you want the wine list now?
No, the Tyneside Hospital was... I remember this being very, you know, it was white enamel beds. It was nursing at a level which I don't think you'd get now. My spinal injury, what had happened to my hip and my spine, that they'd been damaged. And there was a consultant came from, I think, Leeds to look at me and did some chiropractic on me. But the medicine was very, very basic. And the ward, I was quite rapidly moved because I was in traction to a room at the end of the ward, which then I realised was beautiful because it was sunny, because it was a glass wall, a sort of Victorian glass, not quite a conservatory, but a glassed room. But the old guys used to come and die there, really. And it was also, you know, quite powerful and shocking. I saw a lot of death and a lot of, and you know, there's an old man who I think had fought in the First World War. In fact, I know he fought in the First World War. The day he died kind of jumped me in my bed.
Oh, yes.
So wanting to make love to me for the last time. Oh, you know, make love to somebody.
He thought that you reminded him of his wife or something.
Exactly. And it was unbelievably like a scene even now, it feels like a scene in a movie.
Yes.
And I remember that. I remember things like, being horrible. My pelvis and my legs were held. And so to wash me, they had to sort of put a board under everything but my bum, basically, to wash my bum. And this was both very, very sort of shocking and painful. And yet, and this I think is important about the whole story, and yet I think a lot of what happened there may, I learned a lot about how I was going, who I was, and what I could do and what I could put up with. And I don't say that carelessly. I mean,
No. I think the whole story is extraordinary. So it's a very strange thing to talk about trauma and to try and sort of nail it down. I mean, I just want to ask you the straight question. In this hospital and afterwards, what was the worst moment you had? What was the lowest moment?
I do find it hard, this. It's hard because it's a long time ago.
Yes, of course.
And memory is a strange construct. Mm. But there were two or three very kind of pertinent events. I think the most significant for me psychologically was I have this very strong sense of I had finally been released from my traction,
yeah,
and was wheeled out to under a kind of scrubby tree at the back end of this Victorian hospital. And I have this very clear memory of the world and my minuscule part in it, and feeling that was kind of death, and that there were a whole series of mental choices. I'm not sure I thought at the time there were choices to be made.
Yes.
But I think I realized latterly there were choices to be made. And those choices were either to kind of be subsumed by this or not. And I think we've talked on another occasion about how long it took for all these feelings to come together.
Yes.
But I think that in the hospital, in the garden, was a kind of true moment of a breakdown. The universe seemed to have fallen on my head.
Yep.
And I subsequently thought you had to make some choices then. I didn't think that at the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it sort of does, but I think you just get to, it's where physically you're well enough to understand what's going on, and mentally you're sort of vaguely well enough, and that everything is completely bleak. And conversely, I mean, if I said to you, when was that moment when you saw some light at the end of the tunnel that you knew you were going to get out and it was sort of vaguely going to be okay?
I have this very strong memory of the mother of a girlfriend of mine. In fact, she was no longer a girlfriend of mine, but they very kindly took me under their wing. And my parents lived abroad, so this mother came to pick me up from the Royal Victoria Accrington, and they were going to drive me, or they did drive me from Royal Victoria Accrington to their house in Hampshire.
Right.
And I'm smiling because the terror of getting into that car.
Oh, yes, of course.
And the feeling of, and it suddenly cars looked, I don't know, I can't remember what kind of car it was, but it looked very, very dinky. And so when finally we arrived at the house in Hampshire, as I remember it, I was, and that was, I suppose back then, it's about a 5-hour drive. I was bathed in sweat. But, yeah. Oh, my God. I was out of hospital and I was with people who were kind. I was flirting with my ex-girlfriend rather unhelpfully, because I think I'd had my head shaved because they thought they were going to do some work on my, do an operation on my head at some point. And I'd lost a huge amount of weight. So I must have looked just terrible.
Yeah.
And I was on crutches. But I certainly remember that feeling of, wow, we're here. And
no, I get that. And it must be, I mean, what I'm thinking that, you know, because there are various ways one could go on this. And you know, it struck me that you were in there for quite a long time, yeah?
3 months.
3 months, that's a long time. And I don't think you were inundated with visitors. Or were you?
No, it was very, no, my, as I say, my parents lived abroad.
Yes.
So they didn't come. My grandparents came, who lived in Middlesbrough, came over once. And I remember how difficult people found it seeing me, I think.
Yes.
And only two or three people visited, as I recall. And there may be people who said, no, I turned up, but you weren't conscious, so forgive me if I... But there's only two or three. So it was a very long... I mean, thinking about it, speaking with you, Jeremy, it's really interesting because it was a long, lonely time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I think that loneliness gave me a lot of the clues of how I might get through or go forward, I think.
Well, no, I think that you're talking about choices, and... And maybe we're going out of sequence in terms of the conversation, but the expression sink or swim comes into this, I think. And if, for instance, you'd had millions of people coming to see you, and, it's all awful, you know, maybe you wouldn't have grown that resilience or had the resilience to get going. I mean, we know this is what's interesting about post-traumatic stress, that it can... be put into an upstairs cupboard to be brought down at a later stage, and I think that's what we're going to talk about. Okay, got it. I'm not trying to. It's just I think it's just very interesting.
Can I come in on that? I think that what you've just said about post traumatic stress, I almost can't believe how no psychological support was there. In 1976, so much so, and for so long, I thought, well, you know, you just go, well, that's what it was, that the whole thing has a sort of sickening weirdness to me still, because literally strapped to a bed, didn't know the news, didn't know how many people had been killed in the cars, didn't know what happened, didn't know about funerals, didn't know anything. Gradually, bits of information came out. The people who were there, I can only say were kind. But I didn't feel anything other than you just get on with this.
Yeah. You didn't feel nurtured or
I'm not sure I felt unloved, but there was no active intervention at all. So yeah, it's okay. A very strange thing.
Okay, I just want to ask another question. Your mama had come from an extraordinarily tricky background. You know, the Nazis, Nazi Germany, escaping, being Jewish, and, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, traumatic. I just wanted to know this, I mean, and it may have no relevance at all, but what did your mother think of all of this then, when it happened, and afterwards? Was there any sort of input from her, as in, shut up and pull yourself together and stop the nonsense, or
no, Christ. No, again, not an action, not pull yourself together at all. I know that my mother came when I was right at the beginning of I banged my head and I was in a kind of coma, as I'm told. I don't know, but and that's why the head shaved. And she visited and was there and then went. She had two other children to deal with, but didn't. Neither of my parents engaged that much in this at all. I've spoken to them since about it, or spoke to my mother about it, and I think she feels that she sort of possibly missed the sort of significance of what was happening. I'm not sure it's for me to go, well, it's to do with what your past was or anything, or just to do with their relatively busy lives. It sounds so odd now. I just want to stress this. It sounds so odd, and I'm not defending any part of this. But in that there was no seemingly for me no psychological care from any part of the system or individuals. It felt that this is a sort of big disaster, but a disaster that the world will move on from. And thinking about talking with you for the shed. I've been thinking quite a lot about how in that time, how could something like this have happened and not had more effect? I don't know of a memorial service. I don't know of. I didn't know about the funerals. So, there's a strange kind of 1970s cover-up repression, I feel. It's interesting. I've just written this play, as you know, about the Enfield haunting. And I know that I was thinking a lot about the repression of feelings in that story leading to ghost spirits. That wasn't entirely unconscious, but it's really kind of, it's like, I really feel this. Whoa, this is kind of the stuff of not talking about stuff, not marking, not even celebrating.
Can I just ask you one more thing? It's interesting to me. Have you ever written about this stuff, either within drama or Dear Diary?
Well, yes, I have a lot. But I'd say everything I write is about, I think, I don't want to be pretentious, but I think a lot of the work I've done, so Casualty isn't just an exploration of what it's like to be in hospital. Yeah. It's also an exploration of, when life's chances change, what do you feel? And I think I was really trying to write that out there.
It's very difficult not to ask about the people who died. And obviously you were unaware of it up until a certain point, and then you were aware of it, and you thought, I don't believe it, it's happened. You know, it's not like one person died, five other people plus the two in the other car. So your thinking then was, I don't know, because there must have been one or two who were sort of more friends than the others, but I don't know.
I every so often, and it's think about being in touch with surviving relatives and then always don't. It was a grievous thing. I don't like talking about them, not because of some sort of privacy, but because I feel that at the core of this for a long time was immense guilt.
Yes.
To survive something that makes you feel guilty. And one of the things I've had to work through, you talked about my friendship with Arthur Miller. In terms of the consequence of having survived something like that and then having had a life which, for ups and downs, there have been downs and many ups or ups and downs, I feel unbelievably daily blessed to be alive.
Yes.
I don't have a mechanism in which I can understand now what I feel about the people who didn't crawl away from that catastrophe. I feel grief, not anymore. I feel some residual shock, but I also feel a lot. I think I have a kind of sense of what death actually sort of means to us in life, and I feel very. I do. This sounds terrible. I'm not sure it does sound terrible. I can take that back. It's difficult to say, but in some ways I feel that not only was I lucky to survive that accident, but in some ways I was lucky to go through it.
Oh, God, yes.
To go through that suffering, that pain, that event, gives you strength and interest in life and energy.
But Paul, I'm trying to be straight about this. I mean, to me, that's absolutely correct. Because a lot of people, and I'm not just being superficial or cliche, could have finally eventually gone out of that hospital, even though you're only 19, 20, and gone, actually, this doesn't feel great, you know. Now, where is that whiskey bottle? Or where is that, heroin? Or where is whatever? I'll just need that to get through this, because it's the pain of it all. Yes, I can see it. No, I mean, I'm only talking about the others because it's a reflex that, you want to sort of, and of course, luck, it is a very interesting chance,
The difficult thing about luck in this part of my story is that it can curse you. I went through some quite, I'm happy to talk about it. I'm absolutely convinced, though no one ever said it, I had a genuine, full-on psychic storm breakdown in that hospital. I now
when
know.
When you were outside the hospital.
Yeah, I was sitting outside under a tree, and I think at that moment, I got hell and heaven pretty fucking clear.
Yeah.
And hell was right in the middle of me, and I knew what it was. And subsequently, it's taken me quite a long time. I think when for example, I met Kate, my wife, and we've been together 40-something odd years, I used to sleepwalk. And I think what I was doing was trying to get out of the car.
Right.
So, you know, I haven't been to anyone's graves. Funnily enough, there was a very wonderful man, because two of the guys who were killed had gone to art college and were doing, and their tutor, sort of seeing that I was stuck in Accrington on my own, came to visit me. And he's a photographer, Daniel Meadows, a well-known social photographer and an inspiration to many, many people. And he would come and see me in hospital. And about 10 years ago, I wrote him wrote him an email, we had a chat. I said, it'd be great to see you. And he said, yeah, let's get together. And I let it go. And I'm very careful with this part of me.
Yes.
It's not that I don't mind sharing it. I don't mind talking about it. There was a very wonderful sister, ward sister called Sister Caffell, who actually wrote to me after casualty started, and a year or so after casualty started, saying how proud she was
to think that I'd
been inspired, as indeed I had, but she was dying of breast cancer, and this was her. And then I got a letter from her husband saying she died, and it's like an event in fiction, but an event in reality at the same time. If that makes
sense. It's not an easy one to go. I fell off the horse, I broke my neck, I went into a hospital, then I went into rehab, and I, you know, met my husband or whatever. And then I was fine. And, you know, we don't have a huge amount of time, but I've got to ask this. You can't really just say on a piece of paper, oh, yes, I worked with Arthur Miller. It was quite nice. And I became a mate of his. Oh, my God. Paul Unwin, tell me, quick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was extraordinary. I was working at the Bristol Old Vic and read this play called The Archbishop's Ceiling, which was about a building in Prague, which was the Archbishop's Palace, where people met and got bugged by the Russians.
Right.
Irony alert here, my dad at the same time, or roughly the same time, was the ambassador in Budapest, where whenever we went there, the room got bugged. So I read this Arthur Miller play that hadn't been done, thought, God, this is fascinating and really interesting about the Cold War, which, of course, was still raging. Wrote to his American agent, said, I want to put the play on, and thought, well, he's going to say no. But he said yes. And then cut to 2 months later, I thought, well, I better go and talk to Arthur about what he meant about with this play, and whether I really understood it, and also whether he wanted to make revisions to it.
Right.
And so I went to America and went upstate on a Greyhound bus. It was all very, very cool. And got off the bus, and there was the greatest living playwright, Arthur, standing with his Jeep. And he said, it's great to meet you. Come on, you know. And we drove to his house where he lived with Inga Marath, and I stayed there. And
Gosh.
We worked in his shed. I did at one point get to know him well enough later to say, you know, what happened with Marilyn? And he became a great friend. And then 4 years after that, there was a play, I think it was his first or second play, called The Man Who Had All the Luck, which, going back to my other point, I was fascinated by, because it was about chance and luck.
Yes, yes.
Life. And I said to Arthur, could I do that? And he said, of course, yes, we'd become friends. And we did the play just as my daughter was being born.
Good.
At the Bristol Old Vic. So he was great. And he flirted out almost criminally with my life partner, Kate, my wife and woman I've been with for decades. And
great.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was great. It was a great friendship. It was wonderful. We'd go to dinner together when he came to London and all that. It was lovely. Absolutely fantastic.
That's, you know, really something. Yeah. I mean, very few people get to write the sort of catalogue of things he did, you know, because you can just go, you know, all my sons are, and, you know, Death of a Salesman, The Crucible, da-da-da-da. I mean, it's, you know, extraordinary. I mean, anyway, yeah. What I think was very interesting from what I have read about you, and maybe stuff you've written, what is actually, was that you did have that psychic breakdown in that thing outside the hospital. And God, you know, I don't know. Hello, I understand. But that you went, right, I after that, I've got to get on. I've got to do things. I've got to survive. And if I can paraphrase this, and then we'll come back, chop it into bits. What it seemed to me is that quite soon after, well, after you had the year out, after being in hospital, you went to Bristol, drama school, everything. And then, you know, the next 10 years, it seemed to me, were like bingo, bingo, bingo. I mean, you're, you know, cracking away work-wise and having all the success. And I'm paraphrasing it, Paul. But when it gets to the 90s and you met Kate and it's all great and you're having trying to have children, a bit difficult, and then finally you have the two kids, you know, you're going, hello, I don't feel that great. Is it because you suddenly stopped pedalling?
I think it is. It wasn't that I stopped pedalling. It was worse than that. I think I kind of didn't know what to pedal. I don't think, let's be really, you know, basic words. I think the person who came out of the car crash and went to Bristol was so driven, I think I was actually monstrous. I think I was not a particularly kind person. I think I would allow nothing to get in my way. I was bitterly ambitious. And I regret that. I don't like that person.
Yeah.
And I'd say that, you know.
Was that a form of anger and, you know?
Well, anger was part of all of this. So I think that my darker side wasn't resolved, was really raging. So I veered between, this is not depression or antidepression or, you know, up and down this. This was drive, 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 drive. Oh my God, I'm failing. Fury, drive, drive, drive. I can't get what I want, fury. And it was I wasn't stoppable. So it wasn't then that I then ran out of steam. I think I started to look at myself more. And I think I probably, the ambition started to feel shakier, you know. And weird things. I was nominated for an Oscar and went to America. I was terribly grand about it all. And people said, well, you want to make a movie? And I went, no, not really. And I don't know what I thought I was up to, but I felt very vulnerable in the world for a long time. And in that process, started to get more and more help and went to therapy about the accident.
Yes, can we pause that? And just,
yeah.
Because didn't you go to a particular form of therapy,
EMDR. EMDR, eye movement desensitization. I did, but latterly. So I did a lot of talk therapy.
Oh, good.
And very, well, for me, I just kept finding that, well, there's nothing much you could say. It's like, this terrible shit happened. You know, you nearly died. Everyone else died. My God, that's terrible. And I think in the same way, kind of what we're saying to each other, you can't unpack it and go, well, you know. It's kind of, how do you learn to live? So I finally was introduced to EMDR, which is basically a kind of treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
And I walked in going, I haven't got post-traumatic stress disorder. And the psychiatrist said, oh, yeah, sit down here, Mr. Unwin, and ask me a few questions. And I was gibberingly miserable. And then he said, well, there is this treatment, which is to do with your desensitizing, your rewiring your memory, basically. And it seemed risible. Literally, I found this nonsense, this guy doing this thing in front of my eyes. But he was very good at it. And he said, nothing will change.
What's the point? Oh, great.
but then after three sessions, I started sleeping in a way I hadn't slept for ages.
Oh, really?
And truly, what had felt like a cycle in my brain stopped being a cycle. It became a thing. It became a dot that I could, part of experience that I could look at. and talk about more easily. And it worked. I still have occasional nightmares. I still have, which I think are still the accident, I don't know. But they don't have the lingering kind of torturous anger and anxiety that...
Yes, yes. You know, this isn't a sort of Catholic inquiry. Now, I'm interested in the concept of guilt, you know, that maybe there was guilt, you know, in the mix of the afterwards, you know. And I think you said once that it was very important that you wanted to prove you were worth something. And this is going back to, you know, the post sitting on the bench outside the hospital. I mean, it's an often thing that people do think, I want to be a contender.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I definitely felt I had to prove myself. Had to prove myself. But equally, I'd say that my brothers and my sisters are all driven and ambitious, and so it may not be to do with, you know, the car crash at all. They're all done really well, and we are. You know, my wife has this joke that calls it, it's a sort of, you know, the unwin family of achievement. We're all very, very driven. So that might come from before that. But just the psychological cocktail, which I think is what we're talking about in terms of that accident, and we should perhaps move on from it. But what that cocktail is to me, and I think there are some different stages. So the post-traumatic stress of actually being nearly dead in a hospital, realizing, fuck, I came that close to dying, and possibly... I think kind of witness my own death experience. What would it, you know, I think when you're that close, I think I know what it is.
Yes.
That, then I think the longer thing of, oh my God, I'm the only survivor from this thing, which is more of an academic idea, actually. I mean, it's an emotional idea, but, oh, what do I do with this feeling? And then the feeling of how do I live my life? Those three ingredients both made me seem quite clear now and needed to be clarified as life has gone on.
I mean, it's sort of your life has been the real deal because of that, don't you think? You know, that there's lots of people in life who go through life, nothing really terrible happens to them and they just float along. But when you have your head held down in a, you know, a barrel of such awfulness and you come up and you survive it, Christ, that's pretty real stuff. You know, I think I understand, I think, why you were so ambitious in the sense of, and so, in your own words, nasty or whatever it was. Because it's like, you know, forget it, fuck it, I'm going to do this, and you're going to fuck off.
Yeah, and I'm not terribly sympathetic still to... There's a great Dylan line, which is to live a fully intentional life. I'm with that. I'm with... that we really only have one of these. And it's...
Sorry, what was that?
We would really only have one life.
Yeah.
And it really is worth mining it for what it's worth.
Yes.
And I think that leads to adventure. And it also, obviously, by definition, leads to disappointment.
Yes. So, but, you know, you don't waste time.
Try not to.
You get on with things. I mean... I think, you know, because this is Shed Talks and it's, you know, it's about well-being, mental health, I think it's very important that obviously everyone is different. And, you know, when someone has a terrible situation, they're raped, something like that, which is pretty freaking awful trauma. You need to process that quite quickly. Otherwise, I don't know what you think about that. You know,
well, I don't. I really wanted to do this Shed Talk with you because I'd listened to them, and I've also, we've got to know each other as friends, and I've been really interested in the relationship between psychology and kind of creative survival and creative energy. I'm not sure about speed in processing. In fact, I would, if I had a young friend who went through what I went through,
yes,
I would sit with them by their bed and say, take your time, son. Take your time. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. The fact that you very nearly died doesn't mean that that's going to happen again anytime soon. The odds are against it. Just give yourself some time. And I think that's a really...
There's good sense in that, but you've just said something that's important. You go and sit with them. You didn't have that many people coming to sit with you and your thing. It's very important, this aspect, that let's put the terrible car crash to one side for the moment. There's a lot of loneliness out there at the moment, and a lot of people who listen to Shed Talks in the years of age group, it's not all, you know, peaches and cream, because they don't particularly have anybody to talk to. And that is, it makes such a difference. It doesn't have to be a psychiatrist, you know, a therapist and everything and all that stuff. I mean, it can be, I always say this, it can be the bloody ticket collector at the railway station. But you've got someone who gets you and who's going, it's all right, mate. You know?
No, I agree. And I think that in terms of life, one's personality, you go through life, I am immensely teased by my family of always saying hello to everybody. And I don't, and I do that really intentionally, because I think that engagement is aliveness. It has led to me being given free bottles of champagne on long haul flights, but I still stick by it. Like my family will literally go, no, please don't do that. And the event of name tags on people, you know, hello Jeremy, thank you for helping me.
We're giving you an honorary, you know, lifetime associate of Shed Talks, because we want people like you around. I mean, we also want other people who are desperately embarrassed at that.
I know. I embarrass everybody.
It's a mix. I mean, obviously, people think, oh, goody, Paul Lemon's on Shed Talks. He's going to talk all about casualty. And, you know, I mean, casualty is a phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, it's extraordinary. I don't want to say just an utter homiletic cliches. Do you feel happy that you, with Jeremy Brock, created it, unleashed it on the world, and that topics have been covered you believe in?
Yes, I mean, I feel immense pride, and again, a good deal of luck. So Jeremy is sort of my oldest and best friend.
Right.
I'd been doing a play with him. We're both mumbling about wanting to work in television and earn some money, not in the theatre. We'd both been in hospital. We talked about our hospital experiences. He through illness, me through the accident. One of us said, oh, let's do a TV series about a hospital. Honestly, I went to Liverpool to see Kate, my now wife, act in a play, sprained my knee jumping over a wall, went to an A&E department, thought, God, this is like Hill Street Blues. And then Jem and I went to a hospital in Bristol where we're both living, walked in and went, well, the series is writing itself. And we wrote this pitch, which was about the NHS, about a love letter about the NHS, about a multi-stranded drama. And even though I say it myself, reading it more recently, it's a bloody good pitch. It's a, you know, lightning struck in that pitch. We were really on song. But we had no idea what we were doing in terms of writing TV. Yeah. And Jem went into work at the BBC as a junior script editor. I was working in the theatre. On his first day, there was a piece of paper on the desk saying the BBC is looking for a new medical drama. You know, we were 28 and 26. And what we wrote, we thought, was highly political, pro-NHS, anti-Thatcherite television drama.
Yeah.
And it grew rapidly beyond us. We wrote a lot at the beginning of it. I've gone back, Jeremy hasn't, done episodes I've enjoyed enormously and directed that. But it's gone on being this thing that, and now, ever I go to a doctor, my dad was in hospital recently, I was talking to the nursing staff there, and chit-chat, what do you do? Oh, you're a writer, oh, yeah. What have you written, Kathy? Oh, that's why I do what I do. So yes, it's a source of immense pride and pleasure. There have been times where I've thought it's so huge that I think both Jeremy and I share this.
Yes.
I hate this thought, but it's also a truthful thought. What will we be remembered for? It'll just be casualty. And we've done a lot of other things.
Yes.
And I'm driven by that. Though interesting, I'm doing this play, which has, you know, taken a long time to get on.
Is this The Promise?
The Promise, which is about the Labour Party, in 1945, and how they formed the NHS, which is opening in the summer. So I've done, you know, I've come back and back to the same stories. And casualty comes from being in hospital. There's no two ways about it. It comes from lying in hospital bed and seeing the good and the bad. And I suppose, you know, I always say this, but it is a truth rather than a truism. It's a hymn to those that are there for you when you are at your most vulnerable. And the, you know, in that case, it's about nursing staff. But it's something I'm always interested in, is when you're vulnerable, who do you turn to? And that's what the show's about.
Well, I suppose it's whenever I've watched it, I've always felt that it's stressing the humanity of people in hospitals. And
I hope so.
I think for years, didn't you have the, you know, Sister Doughty, or what her name was?
Duffy.
Yeah.
Duffy.
I mean, who was like a sort of saint figure, wasn't she? And,
yeah. Oh, well, there was also Megan, Brenda Fricker's character. And Megan was literally, we think, an Irish saint who kind of, but it's an interesting dramatic notion that for an hour on a Saturday night, you take people to their worst nightmares. You show them how the world might respond if you get your foot torn up in your lawnmower and you're bleeding to death and what the trauma might be like. And hopefully by the end of the hour, you send them away going, actually, the world is all right. People look out for you.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very, very important.
It's a message in a bottle.
Yeah, and I always say this anyway, and you know that I'm rather obsessed with The Long Good Friday as a film, and I've watched it 14 times. You know, the Charlie who was in that final scene, but he was very good in the whole film, and I think he's going to retire soon, isn't he?
He has retired, and only last week or whatever it was, I was on the Today programme bidding him farewell, so yeah.
Oh, really?
The fact it is so long and so popular and, for the most part, can be very good. It's had some downers. It's had some periods where it's gone ridiculously soapy. And then, you know, I think over the last couple of years, it's become really quite an important and authentic voice about an undernourished NHS.
Yes. Well, it'll be very interesting then to see what, you know, what the story is. And in a way, quite good that you must have some influence over perhaps what gets done. I don't know. Or is it?
Really no longer. I mean, used to be, I've known on and off and really enjoyed their company, the producers and executive producers, but it's become about whether they reach out to me and Jeremy.
Yes, I see.
Okay, it's not really in our... And nor should it be, I think. It's no longer an adolescent. It's actually quite a middle-aged...
It's quite grown up. Okay.
But I'm very proud of it, yeah.
And is it strange? Is it not made in Bristol?
It's made now in Cardiff, and that is strange. It was made in Bristol, and then it moved to Cardiff. And if you go to Cardiff, you can have a tour of the set, which is like... one of the better NHS hospital standing. It's kind of incredible set.
Well, I think that's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I'm just thinking that Bristol and you have got a few things. You know, it's kind of weird, isn't it?
It's all the same journey. So I went to university because, frankly, the university drama department. I went to see them on my crutches from this car crash. Looking like a skeleton, and two of the tutors sort of began their interview, and they could see that I was really not very coherent, and they gave me a place. And they, you know, one of them's now dead, but they remained friends for life. And they said, you know, we want you, and that was marvellous.
Yes, and, of course it was.
You know, and then to go to Bristol and to be, and that's what, you know, and I mentioned earlier the sort of driving ambition, the kind of burning need to prove. And that, I think, was problematic for people.
Yeah, well, okay, well, yeah.
I'm happy to talk about it, but...
Okay, well, everyone can write in and go, yes, you were a complete boss. Paul, we've got to park this, which is a really rude thing to say, and we've got to move on to the life jackets section. So what we're going to do, we're going to the life jackets, and these are the things that keep you afloat. And the first thing we're going to go to is a film. And the film you've nominated is a film called The Conformist. tell us all about it.
Well, it's a relatively early Bernardo Bertolucci, and it's set in Rome towards the end of the Second World War, and it's about the collapse of, or it's about the fascist state and then its collapse. And it's a dark, very atmospheric, slightly surreal movie that puts you in a place which is both very real, but very shocking and very you can't sort of pin it down. You can't just go. And after loving his film 1900, the big two-parter he made about socialism in Italy, I stumbled across The Conformists and just thought it was one of the really... it did something about capturing the relationship between politics and intimacy and the political world or being stuck in a moment of history and intimacy. And I found that very powerful.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I've seen a bit of it and it looks very stylish.
It's beautifully made. I mean, it's you know, I'm a photographer as well. And the way everything in that film is shot and staged is very Italian, very kind of 1940s, I don't say fascist art, but it's got a kind of, it's got a subtle touch of that. There's an amazing sequence of anyone who knows the film where finally he is going to get bumped off and they're driving through a forest and the camera tracks through the forest and the people chasing them and they get out of the car and they run through the forest and the camera keeps tracking as fast and fast, and the trees become a blur, and then finally the shot's fired. And it's just a very powerful study it's interesting why I love it so much. It's about intimacy in a public world.
Right.
Which I find really fascinating.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, is what I'm trying to write about in The Promise.
Thank you for that. And now, this is not the first time Hill Street Blues has been recommended on this. I think we've had about three or four people who really like Hill Street Blues. Why is it so special to Sir Paul Unwin of Unwinshire?
Three reasons. The first one is that I love the dialogue and the multi-strandness, so much so that it's inspired everything I've ever done. So stories that weave together, and you'll be with, I can never remember the character's name, but you'll be with the two guys in the car, then you go back to the, and the stories interconnect and cross over like a kaleidoscope. I love that. I love the kind of opening premise of let's go out there and do it to them before they do it to you, and the kind of narrative clarity of that. But the third and the most significant reason was that just before it was made, I was living in New York. This is before I went to Beedale's, with my parents, living a New York life. And Manhattan etched itself in my kind of imaginative world. And so when Steve Bocco's Hill Street Blues appeared, I went, oh, hang on, I know where this is. I know how this is set. And actually, truthfully, there is a fourth reason I love it, is that when Jem and I were starting Casualty, all we said to each other was, it's got to be Hill Street Blues in a medical, in an A&E department. Those are the...
That's very interesting.
So inspiring. It's beyond anything I've ever seen.
Now, I am very, very worried that, you know, we put the business down of favourite pet. And, you know, you've put, no, I don't have any pet at all, but I do... I'll have to say, Kate, I think you're going to get some shot for saying that. But, you know, at least I'm...
I have a dog, but I don't. I refuse to see him as a pet. He's my mate.
Oh, so for goodness sake. Paul, I'm a Catholic archbishop. You have to confess now.
I confess to my best, not my best friend, but Jerry being a dear and intimate part of our lives. And we have had pets. I just don't like the idea of pets. I think that's what it is. I want to be an individualist.
Goodness sake. Can you tell us about your dog, please?
Jerry.
You've got a minute and a half.
Jerry, named after the great and esteemed Lord Jerry Garcia, lead guitarist of the Grateful Dead. My guide and often late night musical buddy is a black working cocker spaniel, and he came into our lives sort of reluctantly and by accident, and has run them ever since. And he's adorable.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Okay, we're moving on now, Paul. We're moving on. We're being very efficient now. You know, I know that music plays a great part in your life, and you are still a drummer, and Steve Gadd is still very worried. Jeff Beccaro is still very worried. I want two lines on this, and you may be rude or you may be complimentary. Charlie Watts.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Precise. Learning his grooves are as hard as they get, weirdly. Gadd's grooves are, like 50 Ways is a classic drum student's thing.
Yeah.
And it's fiddly. But Charlie Watts is not fiddly. It's just where everything happens is so bloody brilliant.
Yeah.
And drumming is all about when everything happens or where everything happens.
Yeah. I love Charlie Watts for all sorts of reasons. You know, I think he was a great guy.
Do you know that YouTube of him, someone saying, can you explain to us about why you set up your drums like you do? Every drummer in the world has watched this. And Charlie goes, well, there's a cymbal. There's another cymbal. There's a snare. I like the Ludwig snare drum, but I use a Gretsch kit. And then the interviewer said, well, what about this? Do you use a Japanese cymbal? He said, yeah, I always break the other ones. And that's all he'll say. And you see him sit there. It's a whole way of holding your sticks, of poise. Drumming is the most rock and roll drumming is dancing. And it's really fascinating because you can never be good enough. I don't know how that's my drum.
You've chosen about 50 things to stay afloat musically. I'm afraid we're only going to allow you two. And one of them is a pop group called Steely Dan. And the other one is a pop artist called Keith Jarrett. Steely Dan, what are you going to say if I said to you, you can only have one album? What's it going to be?
I think it's got to be Asia.
Really?
Yeah, I think Asia is a fantastic album and goes right back the year after I was ill from a car accident, it came out. And I remember opening that purple sleeve and putting the vinyl on. I even remember where I bought it. I even remember where I heard it. And it has some Steve Gadd grooves on it and some Chuck Rainey drumming on it. And it's just sublime. And Keith Jarrett?
Yeah, no, Keith Jarrett, what do you reckon? I mean, you're going to
I love Keith Jarrett. No, I'm not going to go for Cologne. I find Cologne wonderful, but sort of not really not what I love. The album I love is a live album called At the Deerhead Inn, which is they're doing some American standards, and I think he's playing. They're playing, I think, in a club they've played in before, which is upstate New York.
Right.
And his playing and the band are just having a wonderful time, and it's just It's Jarrett at his least sort of up here, and it just feels very soulful. If I was on a desert island, I would play those two albums.
All right, forever. I've got it.
There is a missing link, though. We are missing something. We have Grateful Dead music. You've got to have as well. So then.
Well, obviously, you'll have to come back about the Grateful Dead. Yeah. When the next time you're on, we'll do that. Up on the hill, people never stand. Basically, we're having the hobbies here, and you go, don't have any. Photography and drumming. Well, with drumming, we know that. We know you're into that. Photography, do you still have a camera? Do you use a camera?
I do. I still have a camera. I have spinal injuries from carrying lenses around. I still change lenses, and I still feel I wish I could spend more time trying to work out how to take really great photographs. It's the weirdest thing. I mean, great photography is like a Zen art, a bit like drumming. Bad, it looks easy. Good is so special. And as something of a quester, I'm always trying to find. And it's not really the camera. It's mostly about having the courage to get close enough. I think it was Cartier-Bresson said, you know, if you feel you're close, get closer. To get close enough to be, to feel that. And I love it. I mean, it fascinates me.
That's quite nice, actually, isn't it? I mean, I think the shame in a way is that everyone now has an iPhone and is going, oh, I've got a very good camera, which they are good cameras. But Fantastic. A, they just take a load of pictures and don't really think about it. And B, all those pictures just remain in a phone. And I think more than anything, that's the shame. You know, that I think I like people doing something. I don't care whether you've got a Brownie 127. Go to a bit, get it and put them in an album or up on a wall. Or
yeah, I mean, behind me, I have just, I mean, just these are the photographs I printed recently. But yeah. I have loads and loads of photographs printed. And I mean, I've exhibited, and it's kind of, I love doing it. It's just a case of what are you going to be obsessed by next, Paul? I think it's something my family might say.
So, last but not least, exercise. You are a bit of an exercise nut, according to this. Knee's not brilliant, but you like cycling, walking, skiing. You're a big skier, aren't you?
Yes, I think there may be a past tense coming to that quite soon. But yeah, I love skiing. I love skiing with my kids who I taught to ski when they were young, and they ski fantastically. But you know, skiing is a you've got to do a lot of it to stay fit enough. But I love it. And with all my injury, I've got a lot of it because of the car crash.
Yes.
You see, when after the car crash, they said, you probably won't be walking when you're 40. Certainly shouldn't be skiing or anything like that. And when I got to 40, I said, right, we're all going skiing. So I do kind of try quite hard to keep going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Do you swim?
I used to swim every day. There used to be a swimming pool in a school behind our house, but COVID, it got closed down.
Right. I just wondered, because I would have thought that was probably quite good for you. I mean,
yeah, it is. It's great.
You know, in the sense of just making everything move. And as you know, I'm a qualified doctor, so that's...
Exactly. So no, I'm always relieved. No, if you wouldn't mind checking my heart rate,
great. Okay, Paul. Now, it's sad because there's so much to talk about. We always have this thing where we say a Scottish doctor in, when was it now, 1876, when asked, what do you need to be happy? His name was Dr. McTavish. And he said, you need three things. One, something to do. Two, someone or something to love. Three, something to hope for. And I'd like to know what you think about that.
I think it's beautiful, and I think I've heard it on another of your podcasts.
Awesome.
I would add, sort of humbly, and an absence of regret and an understanding of fear. So I think that for me to be happy, if I regret things, which of course we all do, but to dwell on regret, I think, is incredibly unhappy-making. And I think to live in fear, and I think fear is a really important emotion in the modern world. You know, every time you open the newspaper about climate change, it's like, oh my God.
Oh, yes, everything.
And I think fear leads to neurosis, and I think neurosis is a very particular vortex to go into. So I would say to understand, to be free of regret and not to look forward with fear. I'd add those to the great, ennobled Scottish doctor.
Yes, and so finally, and in a way you've already answered this actually previously with what you just said, that, you know, if somebody knocked on your door now and said, Christ almighty, you don't know what's just happened to me, you know, 6 months ago I was in this car crash, everyone's killed, I'm the only person to survive, and I know that you would say, come in and have a beverage, but what would you say? I mean, maybe you said it, that, you know.
Well, we see it all the time, and you know, I know lots of people are going through difficult things, and I think I think it is worth always finding a way of reminding ourselves that things change. I was going through a very difficult time recently with the bad reviews for my Enfield play, and you were very kind, and you said, you know, it will be different. You will get over this hill, and never a truer word. So I think I would say that. I would say things change. Your understanding of things change. There is no silver bullet in life. There is There is no simple way, but I do think the confidence to know that it won't stay like it is.
And as you said, in a way, it's keep walking, keep going, and
keep walking, and don't live with regret. So I there's a lot I regret. I mean, that car accident. I think, you know, when we talk about survivor guilt, what you're really talking about is survivor regret. I regret that we got into the car. I regret that we didn't. Now, I can live with those things, but they become incredibly toxic. Equally, fear. I get into cars, and I do think every time I get in a car, this thing is a bloody dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Have to go through that. I do really have car phobia, but yeah. I still drive and get driven, and I have to go through that. So we talked right at the beginning about this, of the car crash being this very important part of my life. And I'm saying right at the end of this chat that I think don't live with regret, don't live with fear. And I can explain that in terms of the car crash as well.
I imagine that from my point of view, it would be important that you have some form of acceptance that this has happened and there's nothing you can do about it. Because I think there it would be a great tendency to be thinking, yeah, well, why did that happen? What if this, and, you know, why didn't, you know, that person driven it like that? And, you know,
I think I've got to be very specific. I've not yet had to go through really close-up grief. In other words, there are three or four people in my life who are absolutely fundamental to my existence. And I haven't lost them. And my parents are still alive. So for me, the car accident was a bomb that went off, and the shrapnel flies away from it, and I've got further and further away, and the shrapnel's become sparer, and therefore it's less dangerous to me. But I haven't got that. So I can't lecture anyone on how do you live with the unimaginable.
Yeah.
And I would really be, you know, while I've been through the unimaginable, I can't tell you how to do it. Because it was unimaginable. And I think the other thing I'd say is that it's not, I don't have the steps. You know, this is a podcast about mental health. I've been up and down as a result of life. I've also been up and down as a result of that car crash. And I've been up and down in all, you know, and I've had to deal with those ups and downs in different ways.
Yeah.
I think I'm beginning to understand that, oh, you've got quite a lot of reserve. Things, you know, oh, that's interesting, you're quite strong, but that's about all I know. I mean, literally, even that's putting it quite high, you know, high up.
All right, you know, we can't work everything out, but I mean, anyway, listen, it has been great having you here, Paul. That's been really, really interesting, and we understand everything backwards. That's what I say, and I shall know. Yeah, all right, Paul Unwin, we say thank you, we love you, and we're going to be in every episode of Counting to You in the next 3 years. Great. Thanks a lot, Paul. I'm going to say farewell.
Take care, my love. I enjoyed that. Thank you so much.
And this has been an Anglo-Greek production on this episode, but we're now back to the Anglo side, and it's a delight to see our old friend Karen Cowan sitting opposite us. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, how nice to see you.
Well, here we are, and this was an extraordinary episode, Paul Unwin. And, I mean, really, I guess you've got an awful lot to say, but generally speaking, before we get into the trauma and all that, what was your impression?
I just thought it was an absolutely wonderful story that Paul gave of his own survival, his love of life, and his insight into himself. And I thought it was wonderful, even though he's done so much more than casualty in his life, of course.
Yes.
But it's amazing to go from that huge trauma of the crash, making a television series about trauma.
But, yes. I think all the stuff with Arthur Miller alone. But what's interesting is how, you know, we're often defined by one thing. How great that he's not defined by that car crash. He said, listen, I realised I was so lucky.
lucky to be alive. And he went on with that attitude in a way that, you know, he's looking back now at his life, and he thinks he does have all that gratitude and sort of, God, it's all been great.
Yes, very much the gratitude. And I'm interested how it links to, because he said a lot of his family had a great deal of drive and with that goes love of life. And I wonder if it's also linked to the generational trauma of what his mum went through, you know, related to escaping the Holocaust, etc. And
yes.
So, again, the sort of the survival, the I'm lucky, I've got to take the most out of life because I've survived. I'm living the life of lots of people.
So basically, right at the beginning of this episode, I said that this is an episode discussing trauma and in particular PTSD. This car crash was unbelievably awful. I mean, it was 7 people were killed, all survived. He was on his own pretty well in hospital. Parents were abroad working as diplomats. What's your take on all of this? What I mean, because it's quite interesting to have some, you know, just some basic explanation about PTSD and getting over trauma.
Well, obviously the incident is absolutely huge, and the fact that he survived it is huge. His injuries are huge. The fact that he was, you know, almost sexually assaulted by one of the other patients while he was ill. He's bound to have symptoms of trauma. And I suppose the definition of post-traumatic stress disorder, people often say that one of the prerequisites of it, although that's going out of fashion a bit, is that you must have thought that you were going to die in the incident, which of course he did, and he must have done it in hospital as well. But some of the symptoms are numbing, flashbacks, nightmares, extreme anxiety, hypervigilance, you know, sort of watching for things all the time. I mean, he still has obviously remnants of it, including the car phobia that he mentioned. You know, the car is obviously a trigger.
Which I thought was huge, actually. Didn't even think about it, but he said every time he gets in the car.
But I wonder if also the fact that he had what he describes as a psychic breakdown when he was sitting outside the hospital.
Yeah.
Psychic breakdowns, I mean, it's not necessarily a formal term, but are absolutely huge, like what you might call a brainstorm, almost psychotic. And I wonder if that kind of helped him a little bit.
Yes, and I wondered, what does that mean? Does that just mean where you just, you know, lose control of everything, and it's, you know, it's sort of, you know, bursting into tears times, you know, 1,000. I mean, I'm interested, you know.
Yeah, it would be that. A psychic breakdown, as he describes it, would have been just completely not being able to cope. I suppose what you call losing it, and it might include a sort of form of psychosis, you know, seeing things, feeling things that weren't there. And so on. But it sounds like it was quite brief, you know, it was just when he was out. Yes.
The interesting is that he was 19 years old.
Yes, not even a formed adult, really.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so you're lying in a hospital bed, all these terrible things, and basically you get the idea in the end that all your compatriots, your mates and your band are dead. The other 2 people in the car are dead. I'm saying to you, and I want to know what you think, you know, was that in the end for him so awful that it became sink or swim?
I think it probably was a question of sink or swim. And I think he probably really went for it with the ambition and perhaps numbed it all out. And then, as they always say, it always comes back to get you. And it came back, you know, in a big way. I think he probably had, you know, almost certainly had survivor guilt, which often makes you have a lot of drive to live the other people's lives almost.
You know, it seems to me and it's not that I like the story, but there's so much truth in this story, there's so much verite. He talked about he was sleepwalking, and in his own analysis was he was trying to get out the car.
Yes. Perhaps when he got married, he felt a bit safer in life and things started coming out, you know, such as the sleepwalking and trying to escape. Yeah, nightmares and sleepwalking would be part of PTSD.
Yes. In some ways, I think when these things happen, some people could take a view and go, well, this is stuff and nonsense. That's the making of him. You know, we all need these sorts of things to happen, you know, and you think, God almighty. But in some ways, there is an element of truth in that, that he flew off from that in the end. And, you know, I thought it was a very sweet story. An old girlfriend and her mother came, the only people really came to see him, and they took him home, you know, at the end. And, you know, that was a bridge, that he had people who liked him and it was going to be okay. But he had this absolute determination to be successful. And he said, I think, didn't he? He said, I became a very unpleasant person.
Yes, he did say that. And I suppose what sometimes happens in the will to survive is that you do and become things you don't want to be in order to escape.
But we were talking about guilt, and I was saying that, you know, this is what's amazing, is that he's 19. And he could sort of had a natural instinct to go, fuck it, I've got to do this. I'm sorry that everyone's died, but deep down, I've got to do this, otherwise I won't survive.
Yes, you know, very much so. I've got to survive, and you know, perhaps I, you know, because I'm so lucky, I have to survive in as big a way as possible, and perhaps sort of subconsciously for the others. And he talks about luck a lot, and chance, and he feels that, you know, he was lucky. It feels like he lived in a way which he had to kind of deserve to live.
Yeah, got you. I mean, of course, we're talking about something that happened in 1976. So an awful lot of therapeutic things. I mean, okay, they were available, but there weren't certainly anything like we have now.
And almost nothing, I would have thought.
Yeah. So, I again, what are you going to do when you wake up in that hospital? You've understood everyone's dead. You understood no one seems to be coming to see you apart from two people. You know, what am I going to do? I thought one of the things I said to Paul, which wasn't sort of making a moral judgment or anything, but I wondered how much he thought about the people who died, and, you know, how nowadays would be a big hoo-ha. Been on social media, there'd be a massive church service. I mean, we make much more of it, I think.
Yes, an absolutely huge event. It would have been all over the press now. And of course, you say it's 40 years ago, but with an event such as that, or any big trauma, you know, it's always going to be there. I mean, he's worked on himself. He's done EMDR, which is very, you know, well-researched treatment.
I mean, I would have thought that post-traumatic stress, well, I don't know, I was going to say would demand therapy, you know, because you want to get all these awful things off your chest out of you. But actually probably doing something manual as well, building something, you know, building a house, running a riding stable, being a fireman. I don't know, you know, that you actually do things at the same time.
Something in trauma as well that's often quite important to go through is sometimes you kind of lived without the facts, right? And if there's a way of finding out exactly what the facts are, and that's often something that happens in therapy, because you often think somehow it was your fault, or where I sat in the car or something, but sometimes you can go back to the therapy, go back to the road almost, and see,
yes,
that couldn't possibly have been.
But well, I think there's another theme that we've had in other episodes, which I think is quite interesting, which is being powerless and not having any power. And in this case, say, and not trying to be clever, but with Paul, that it may well be that he needed to regain or to gather power so that he could function.
Yes, I think you might well be right, you know, and gain agency. I mean, the time in the hospital, I think he was in a form of traction.
Yeah.
He will have been utterly powerless then. And he described the washes he had.
Yeah.
and that lack of total lack of power.
I think
you may well be right, is gaining some power and agency. That's why sometimes people want money to protect themselves.
But I can see that again. I have to repeat this, that he was only 19. And maybe if he'd had parents who were right next door and were rather, mollycoddling type, and maybe if he'd had a propensity to drugs or to drink, it would have gone a different way. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know about the parents, because I think sometimes sort of overindulgence might be a good thing. But I do think that, he could easily have become a drug addict or an alcoholic.
Yes.
He's missed it by a whisker.
Yeah.
I think the fact that he had this enormous survival instinct that perhaps actually came from his parents who were away saved him, because it's absolutely extraordinary that he didn't become an alcoholic or a heroin addict.
Yeah. It's fascinating that he went on, to do Casualty, and quite extraordinary. I mean, it's almost a joke. It's so good.
It really is. And he should congratulate himself, because some people may well have committed suicide over it, but he wanted to grab life. He wanted to survive. He felt life was a gift.
Yes.
Was a present that he must not throw away.
Well, I also think that he, Paul, is an outgoing, outward, grab hold of life person.
Yes.
Well, my last words on this, I heard him say that when he was in that hospital garden having that psychic breakdown, he sort of knew suddenly what heaven and hell were about, particularly hell. But then later on he said, I knew what death was from a very early age. I knew the reality.
Yes.
That's quite a big deal.
Yes.
Most of us go, oh dear, Aunt Vera's popped off. Well, she was 96, but we don't really have any idea.
I'm never going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, also, you don't know. He did know.
Yes.
And he was in that hospital ward. I mean, that's, talk about a baptism.
Dying all around him. Yeah.
I mean, of course, this is like people coming back from the Second World War, horrible concentration camps and things like that. But you don't want to talk about it, but it's really messed you up.
Yes.
And what I admire about Paul is his honesty in saying, I was lucky. I was lucky not only to survive, but I was lucky to be able to channel things like Casualty that really worked. And how lucky am I? So I think that's great. What I admire about Paul Unwin is that he's a very honest character, and not everything that he says is saccharine nice. He says some quite difficult things sometimes about himself and what's happened. So I like that very much, but I like the fact that he is someone who feels that he's been very lucky, not just with the car crash, but lucky in life to have had the opportunities he's had. And he's a tip-top chap, I think. What do you think?
Yes, I was incredibly impressed by him and absolutely loved hearing his story and his sense of gratitude and the idea of luck and finding out about himself and understanding himself, bad and good. And I think he's the most amazing survivor. He's made a really good fist of his life, and I hope he carries on to enjoy life as he has done.
Great. Karen, that's another episode done, and that's really a good one. And thank you very much for coming all the way over. And we look forward to the next episode, which I'll tell you all about later.